the passage that we're considering is that passage which we read earlier on, Proverbs chapter 30 and verses 21 to 28. You'll have heard that popular Christian expression, which is based loosely on the words of Scripture itself, where we say that Christians are called to be in the world, but not of the world. And that's true, isn't it? Christians are called to be in the world, but not of the world. And that's a very difficult calling. You get up on the morning, you drive off to work, you start listening to the radio, and suddenly you are conscious of the world around you and what it's like. You hear a segment about the rivalry going on between our world leaders and underhanded diplomacy taking place, Trump, Putin, Starmer, Netanyahu, whoever it might be, and it gets you down, it depresses you. But that's then followed by another segment on the radio about some tax-evading billionaire. That's followed by another segment about some corruption in a well-known charity. And you sigh then, and you feel down, and you arrive at the office and you go into work. But all day long, your colleagues there in the office, they're no better. They're gossiping. They're bad-mouthing one another, bad-mouthing another member of staff maybe, complaining about someone's promotion. They're annoyed that they haven't been promoted themselves. And after all of that, then you sigh after another day of work. And you go home that evening, but sooner or later you find yourself on the telephone to some family member, and you're told then that there's been some upset in the wider family, and there's a fallout between an exasperating parent and a selfish son or daughter, and again you sigh at that. And then you turn on the television and you hope then to sort of get out of it all and to have a bit of time escaping from the world, but you can't sit down and enjoy it in the way that you'd like to. Before the program begins, you're bombarded with adverts, those betting adverts about Bet365 or Foxy Bingo or Ladbrokes. And so it goes on all around you then, this world of selfish ambition, the greed and resentment, the rat race, the constant struggle for power and prosperity and autonomy, and at times it seems to encompass everyone and everything. How do you deal with all that? How do you respond to all of that? How do you think straight amongst all of that? And how do you participate meaningfully in society, as Christians are called to do, without finding yourself dragged down the broad way which leads to destruction? Well, in Proverbs chapter 30, this man who we've been reading about in recent months, this man who we know only by the name of Agur, once again he speaks his wisdom into our lives. And I think he does help us to think straight in this world around us. And this evening then I simply want us to see what he has to say to us in these verses 21 to 28. And really I want to divide these verses, this passage, into two parts. The first part is verses 21 to 23, and the second part is verses 24 to 28. And I have two points then which line up basically to those two parts. And the first point I want to make this evening is this. Agur condemns unnatural power. Agur condemns unnatural power. I want to treat verses 21 to 23 as a chiasm. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that in these verses, starting really from verse 22 there, Agur lists four individuals, and the first and last individuals on that list, they pair up symmetrically. And the third and the second individuals on the list, they also pair up symmetrically. And if you're not quite following me there, don't worry, because I'll explain myself in just a moment. So what I think Agur is presenting us with in these verses is a series of scenarios in which people obtain power and prosperity in a way that is unnatural. We'll leave verse 21 aside for a moment, but just look at how verse 22 begins. It begins with this slave who becomes a king. We said a couple of sermons ago, so probably a couple of months ago now, that the word we translate here, slave or servant, could also be translated official. So if you go back to verse 10, you'll see there that Agur says, do not slander a servant to his master. We said at the time that he could be saying, do not slander an official to his master. And what he could be then saying in verse 22 is, he's talking about this situation in which an official becomes king. And I think that does change the tone of that verse a little bit, because it means that what Agur is getting us to imagine here is not a situation in which you might have a lowly character like a Joseph rising up to the side of Pharaoh, or a character like lowly David rising up to become the king, or a character like Esther, the orphan, who rises up to become the queen of Persia. No, we're imagining a situation, rather, where the king's official, and maybe this is even the king's right-hand man, you know, someone like Abner or someone like Joab, where that man then becomes king himself. And that is an unnatural situation. Because how were kings appointed in the days of the Old Testament? Well, they were appointed. There was a divine right, wasn't there, which passed from father to son to son to son. And the prophets and the priesthood validated that, ideally. And if that process was going to be invalidated, again, it was to be done only through God's expressed will. So, for instance, King David does replace Saul. He's not the son of Saul, but he does it in a way which is validated by God himself. It was never right for just some official to assume the role of king. That was against the divinely sanctioned order. David himself, of course, recoils. He recoils from taking power like that from Saul. So that's the first person on this list, verse 22, this official who becomes king. What we're seeing here is something unnatural. It's exploitative. It's a defiance of the social order. But now look at the last person on the list. And the last person on this list in verse 23 is this maidservant displacing, or dispossessing, we could say, her mistress. Driving out her mistress is the idea. And I think this example at the end, it mirrors the first example we've just been considering. That's why it's a chiasm. Because elsewhere in the Bible, that word which is translated here, mistress, is simply an honorary title which is given to a queen. Elsewhere, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 19, the word is literally translated queen. So what exactly are we imagining here? Well, maybe we're imagining something like this. It may well be that you have this attractive maidservant living within the palace, and she's getting a bit too friendly with the king, and she's pouring her seductions into his ears, and eventually she wins over his heart, she becomes his new lover, and the queen is dispossessed. She's driven out because of what this attractive young maidservant has done. And again, we're seeing the same kind of thing. This is the unnatural acquisition of power. This maidservant who displaces the mistress, displaces the queen. So they're the two outer examples of the chiasm. But now let's move into the middle section. And you've got here the fool when he is filled with food. And then you've got this unloved, or we could say hated woman. I think the KJV says something like odious woman who gets a husband. And again, I would put it to you that what we're seeing here is something unnatural. We're not supposed to feel sympathetic towards these people. No, these are unworthy, disreputable characters. You know how the book of Proverbs talks about fools. It doesn't talk about fools in the same way that the New Testament describes Christians as fools. No, rather it talks about fools in an extremely negative sense. These are selfish people. These could be violent people, these could be lazy people, bad-mouthed people, sexually immoral people, people who lack self-control. And these are the kind of people who the book of Proverbs tells us that under natural circumstances should spiral into a state of destruction. Ultimately, the actions of these people, the selfish, sinful actions of these people, should lead them on a path into misery. But what Agur is telling us here is that sometimes that doesn't happen immediately. Sometimes the lazy fool comes into money, and he is able to spend all of his days growing fatter and fatter on his bed. Sometimes he might even become the king. Sometimes the proud, foul-mouthed, untrustworthy, unloved Jezebel marries. And sometimes she marries a powerful man like King Ahab. Sometimes an unlovely woman marries a man like Potiphar. And so you see then, the book of Proverbs, it tells us that as a general rule, foolishness as a way of life fails, but only as a general rule. Because what Agur is showing us here is that he knows full well that very often the foolish way of life doesn't look like failure in our eyes, at least not at first. Sometimes, actually, these foolish people find themselves inheriting power and prosperity. There's a realism to Agur's oracle, and it's a realism that I think we can all identify with, isn't it? You may well have seen ruthlessness rewarded in your workplace. You may well have seen that friend of yours who is gossiping the co-worker excelling in life because of their gossip, fueled by bitterness. Every now and again, some greedy lazy man walks down to the bottom of his street, goes into the post office, buys a lottery ticket, and walks away a millionaire. It does happen. That's the real world. What do we make of that then? What do we say about that? How do we respond to that? What does Agur make of that unnatural acquisition of power and prosperity? Well, this is what he makes of it. He realizes that while those people might be prospering right now, in the end, the result for those people is still doom. Verse 21, under three things the earth trembles, under four it cannot bear up. I want to try to explain that verse to you. In the early days of the internet, well, not quite the early days of the internet, the early days of YouTube, when I was still a teenager, I used to watch various bits and bobs on there. And I remember watching for a time a series of videos which were called, "Is it a good idea to microwave this?" And generally the answer to that question was no. And they would put various objects in the microwave then, and I remember them putting in this light bulb into the microwave and setting it on the pasta and pizza setting and then sort of running away hurriedly behind a tinfoil shield. And, you know, you start watching that thing and the microwave starts for a while looking quite normal and everything looks perfectly safe and fine, but then the light bulb starts glowing little colours and unusual colours that you don't normally see from a light bulb. And then there's a pop and then there's a lot of smoke. So it's not a good idea to microwave a light bulb. It's unnatural. It doesn't end well. And I think Agur is very simply saying something like that in verse 21. When the wicked prosper in this world, there's something unnatural which is happening there. Something deeply wrong is taking place. It's as if it's a challenge to God's order. In the words of Proverbs 26, verse 1, like snow in the summer or rain in harvest, so honour is not fitting for a fool. There's something unnatural about it. But also, Agur seems to be saying that this unnatural challenge to God's order, it doesn't end well, like the light bulb in the microwave. When you challenge God's natural order like that, you're doing something stupid. You're doing something futile, ultimately. Because when the wicked do prosper, it's almost as if the universe itself is being forced to entertain something it knows is deeply, deeply unnatural, something inconsistent. And while it might be able to harbour that for a little while, long term, it just cannot handle it. In the words of Agur, you're forcing God's own universe to bear up under something completely impossible. And so Agur is saying, you look, the earth's starting to tremble. And that word tremble, it really does carry the idea of agitation, enragement, frustration, as if the creation itself is feeling some deep part of its fibres, it's feeling some moral outrage as these things take place. And that's what we're seeing in the world around us then. We sang earlier on about the the bitter wars, that rage being birth pains of a coming age. The first few signs that all is not well with that microwave which is trying to entertain the light bulb. It's making the funny noises and emitting the funny smells, and now it's starting to shake. And we know that things are not going to end well. And this is Agur saying then, he's condemning all of those for who for a short time might be profiting from their wickedness. He's saying, look, maybe now you're profiting, but not forever. And as I say then, the Bible does depict the whole creation as quite literally in a state of deterioration, trying to entertain something which is unnatural. Ever since sin entered the world in Genesis 3, the creation has been bearing up under something impossible. You know, we notice here the kind of topsy-turvy relationships between the various people acquiring power unnaturally. We see that in Genesis 3, don't we? We see the serpent who should be under man's feet getting dominion over man. We see the woman who should be under man's leadership leading the man into sin. And then we see the man and the woman who should be under God together rebelling against God and placing themselves over him. And the whole creation is trembling at those things, and it has been trembling since day one. But not forever. One day God will deal with that problem like never before. One day God will answer to those growing birth pains, and he will answer them with the new age. He will strip the world from gossiping and backbiting and oppression and rebellion. Remember that when you look around you in this world and you feel yourself being dragged down the way of the world, and it's whispering into your ear telling you that this is the way you should be going about things. Remember that that broad way, it looks like it's prospering for a time, it ends in destruction. So Agur, he condemns unnatural power. That's what I mean. Well, that's my first point. And as we move on to my second point, you might just have this thought. You might think, well, okay, so Agur is saying some sensible things here. This kind of makes sense. This is helpful. But I can't quite shake the feeling, reading these verses, that Agur actually does still have some quite old-fashioned views, especially when it comes to social mobility. You know, I just get the sense here that Agur is not much of a democrat. In his view, kings should remain kings, the poor should remain poor, the powerful should remain powerful, the powerless should remain powerless. That's Agur's view on the world. At least this side of eternity. Maybe you think that. How do we respond to that kind of criticism? Well, I suppose this is where I'd want to draw our attention to the remaining verses in our passage, verses 24 to 28. Because it's here that we see, actually, Agur has something really important to remind us here, and quite surprising to remind us. Actually, humble, self-controlled wisdom, the kind of wisdom which Agur is being encouraging all the way through this oracle, that kind of wisdom actually, in its own way, leads to a kind of power and a kind of prosperity that selfish impulse never, never could. And this then brings me on to my second point. This is what Agur is doing in these next four verses. He's already condemned unnatural power. He's now commending natural power. He's commending natural power. And I'm not quite sure that's the best way to express this. It sort of feels like a natural opposite to my first point. I think perhaps we have to be careful with those words natural and that word power. Those words are easily misunderstood. But to clarify, in essence, what I'm saying here is this. Godly, sensible, wise living, living in accordance with God's natural design, which he's encouraged in the previous section, that itself leads to a form of power and a form of prosperity which is actually healthier and more stable and longer lasting than anything which sin could bring about. It leads to a lifestyle fundamentally that should be more deeply peaceful, more deeply joyful, more fulfilled, and in its own way actually more empowered. That's what Agur is promising those who follow the path of wisdom. And to illustrate this, he brings to our attention these four beasts in verses 24 to 28. All of these beasts are small, they're all weak, they're all at a natural disadvantage, they're born into a low rank in the created order, but Agur's point is that simply by employing wisdom and suppressing their selfish instinct for power, they enter into a better kind of strength and prosperity in the long run. So let's just look at these creatures in these following verses, and let's just see if we can draw out and identify the wise principles which Agur is commending to us. So first of all, we have the ants. The ants. Verse 25. The ants are a people not strong, yet they provide their food in the summer. What do we have here? Well, clearly Agur is commending to us industriousness, a good work ethic. But I think if we read between the lines here, there's something more than that. He's commending to us the power of foresight. Proverbs chapter 6 elaborates on this. Listen to these words. Doing a very similar thing to Agur. They start, "Go to the ant, O sluggard." You're looking at the ant for your example. "Consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man." So the ants, they're mindful about what the winter holds, and they defend themselves against it while there's still opportunity to do that. They gather their food in the summer. And so it's the knowledge that by working now, and not by lounging around now, and not by overeating now, I will be able to actually eat later on when hard times come. It's the forestallment of pleasure. It's the sacrifice of immediate gratification for the sake of long-term future benefits. And it's, of course, not a uniquely Christian insight, but it is a profoundly wise insight. And it rubs up against the instincts and the intuitions of the flesh. And it's one which the Bible does enshrine and encourage, sacrificing what one might have now for the sake of gaining better things that you might have later on. So you might not have the brains of the other classmate under normal circumstances. He might do better than you in the exam. But if you can commit to the discipline of revising now, while he plays video games, you may very well be better off when the exam comes. That's the basic principle. So that's the ants. Secondly, we're looking at the rock badger. Verse 26, the rock badgers are a people not mighty, yet they make their homes in the cliffs. Probably these animals are what we call today rock hyraxes. They're not impressive in themselves, these animals. As I said at Winlayton, they're basically walking balls of meat and fluff. They're easy prey for a hungry predator. But they manage to survive as a species. Now, how do they do that? How do they survive? Well, they don't do it through some complex defensive strategy. No, they do something very simple. They stay out of harm's way. They live up in the cliffs. They make their homes in the cliffs where they're safe. And I think the basic principle which Agur is commending to us is a spirit of caution. He's promoting not a cowardly lifestyle, but he's promoting a common sense lifestyle. You don't go looking for trouble. And in fact, what we've seen in this oracle already is the example of people who do go looking for trouble, so it seems. The man who carelessly slanders the official. The lad who carelessly wanders nearby the adulteress's house. These are people who are asking for trouble, Agur is saying. It's almost as if the possibility of getting into trouble excites them. Maybe it does excite them. Maybe it excites you. But Agur is warning them it's a trap. Because there's a hungry lion out there who prowls about for their souls and offers them nothing but ruin in life. And he's saying, look, if you don't want to be eaten by that lion, there's a very simple thing you can do. It's not complicated. Be like the rock badger. Know where the predators lurk. Know your own danger areas. And then just don't go there. Don't lower your guard. Don't go wandering in places where you're likely to be cornered. Avoid sin. know where it lurks. It's very simple, but it's exceedingly wise, and ultimately it's to your benefit. You know, you might ask the question, do you think Harvey Weinstein feels powerful and prosperous right now? Do you think Prince Andrew feels powerful and prosperous right now? Do you think powerful and prosperous is how Jeffrey Epstein felt in the final days of his life? From one perspective, maybe. But from a sober and obvious and very simple perspective, certainly not. They are lumps of meat in the mouth of a predator. And you'd rather be a rock badger in the cliffs than be that. So that's the rock badger. Thirdly, we have the locusts. Verse 27, the locusts have no king, yet all of them march in rank. You remember that sermon which I preached back in the autumn about locusts? One of the strangest decisions I've ever made. But we observed on that occasion that it's interesting, we have this picture of the locust as a military metaphor coming up quite a lot in the Bible. And it's a picture then of these creatures which, on the one hand, are small and fragile and they can be easily swept into the sea by a gust of wind, but nevertheless, when they work together, they become a force of nature, which the book of Joel reminds us can easily wipe out an agrarian economy in a matter of moments. And where do they get this force from then? Well, it's not in selfish autonomy. It's not in doing their own thing, however tempting that might be. No, it's in unity and cooperation. The individual locust sacrifices something of its own freedom for the sake of the social order. It recognises the concerns of the broader group. It sacrifices its autonomy to that group, and the result is terrifyingly impressive. And again, it's not a uniquely Christian insight, but it is a particularly Christian insight, isn't it? And it's one, I think, that the Lord's people, above all, should be capable of embodying more than anybody else. You know, you think of Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Russia. They saw the value of unity, of group force. And in their case, they enforced it upon the people. And they squeezed all possible autonomy out of the individual. The individual was lost in this just mass of people in the nation. That's not the way of the ants, actually. Because the unity that the ants show is a voluntary, happy unity. What we're told there is that they don't have a king. They don't need a king to force them into union. No, unity is just part of their DNA. And it should be like that with the church, shouldn't it? We of all people should be able to give up on seeing ourselves as the main character of the universe and rather share each other's concerns in the church quite happily and cooperate for the sake of the kingdom and for the sake of each other without being pressured into doing that. That's the kind of unity Agur, I think, is commending here. That's that principle. And then finally, we have the lizard. Verse 28, the lizard you can take in your hands, yet it is in kings' palaces. Again, the principle is simple. You have this creature who is puny in its own right. Its entire existence can be held in a man's hand and then squashed if he so chooses. But he isn't squashed. The lizard just sits there on the wall, quite happily, quite innocently, enjoying all of the benefits of the king's palace. And I think if we were to try to summarise the real principle here, we could maybe describe it as something like quiet boldness. Quiet boldness. So you see, the lizard, just like the rock badger, it invites no suspicion, does it? It doesn't draw attention to itself. It doesn't go looking for danger. It's not a threat. It's not a rebel. It doesn't cause a nuisance. And Agur has commended all that. But unlike the rock badger, it's bold. It's fearless. It's forthright. It's confidently enjoying whatever blessings it can get its hands on. It's that quiet boldness which the lizard embodies. Now, I really, really always hated the expression shy bairns getting out, because I am a shy bairn, and I feel least equipped then to teach you about the ways of the lizard. But there is something to that, isn't there? And I guess I'll just allow yourselves to work out exactly how you might apply this principle. But I would just say this, that if you have until now followed Agus Wise principles, if you've shown yourself to be that employee or that pupil or that friend who is basically sensible and basically thoughtful and basically cooperative and not rebellious and not selfish but self-sacrificing and conscientious and obedient, then probably you are the person who is best placed to also be quietly bold. You are precisely the kind of person who will be listened to when you quietly but boldly make that request or make that criticism. It's worth meditating on, isn't it? You can be bold as a Christian. You can be like that lizard because you are a wise and sensible person. So, I'm coming to the end now. Let me just summarise, I suppose, what we've been looking at. And as I close then, let me just see the main point that Agur is drawing our attention to. Look, the world rushes on around us. And it invites us to throw ourselves into it. And it invites us to give ourselves up to selfish ambition. And it tells us that if we don't do that, and if we don't act fast, and if we don't play by its rules, we will be the dog's breakfast. And we've already said that there is much injustice in this world, much oppression in this world, which is, for a time, just allowed to go ahead and carry on. But what Agur is telling us is that actually there is a better way in this world. By playing by another set of rules, God's rules, by employing wisdom, and I think ultimately by embodying the life of Christ, and I suppose there's a heaviness in my heart that we haven't spent long enough meditating upon him this evening and seeing how he himself embodies, I think, these wise principles. But it's worth our reflection. He does embody these wise principles. By meditating upon him and imitating him and embodying these principles, we actually enter into something better than what the world has around us. Something more deeply powerful. Something more deeply prosperous. Maybe even materially prosperous at times. All of these creatures who are ostensibly weak through wisdom become strong. And this is not the kind of strength which is granted by lust. It's not the kind of strength which is granted by impulse. It's not the kind of strength which is granted by grasping and bitterness. And let me tell you, that is not the kind of strength that you want anyway. Because that kind of power and prosperity is fragile and volatile and corrupting and self-defeating. And that's what Agur has been telling us all the way through this oracle. It ends ultimately in disaster. No, Agur is promoting this disciplined, orderly, unselfish, healthy and ultimately Christ-like strength. And let me commend you to that to you this evening. Let me just finish then with the words of Proverbs chapter 21. Verses 21 to 22. Whoever pursues righteousness and kindness will find life, righteousness, and honor. A wise man scales the city of the mighty and brings down the stronghold in which they trust. Let us be like that wise man this evening. Amen.